Hi, this is Tom Regan. I'm a licensed addiction counselor and certified grief counselor for Heartview Foundation in Bismarck. Welcome to Recovery Chronicles. This is a half-hour interview program that celebrates recovery from alcohol and drug addiction. And our guest today is Josh Frazee, and he's 40 years old, 7 years in recovery. Which is a lot to be, almost 9 days and you'll be 7 years, a lot to be, that's really a lot to be proud of. Your drugs of choice, as you said, were, marijuana and other drugs, but
marijuana and pretty much whatever I could get my hands on.
That sounds familiar.
The quickest way to sum it up.
Okay. And I should add that today you are an addiction counselor.
I am.
For Heartview Foundation. And so thank you for, you know, having the courage to come on the and I'd like to ask you, why did you agree to come on Recovery Chronicles to tell your story?
Well, I think it's a great forum. I can hope my story, along with other people that I have shared on the show, might help people in the community understand this experience, whether it's somebody that's maybe going through what I've been through or somebody that's a family member of somebody going through this stuff that just doesn't quite understand, you know, why can't they stop? Why it's so easy? Why can't they just stop? And
right.
All these questions that surround the experience of addiction.
Yeah. And that begs the question. I mean, let me ask you that question.
Okay.
Why do people feel that way, family members, et cetera? And why can't addicts just stop?
Why do people feel that the person that is drinking or using should be able to stop?
Mm-hmm.
I think because from their perspective, it makes sense that they should be able to. Especially when the consequences start pouring in, when we're getting DUIs, we're getting in trouble with the law, we keep losing jobs, we keep having all this bad stuff happen, it should make sense to any clear, rational mind. Well, then you should just stop what's causing all these things. Why the addict can't do that, I've learned over the last several years that there's a lot of science going on with neuroplasticity in the brain that explains that to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
When they talk about this as a disease, it really is something that, you know, they talk about permanent, you know, how drinking and drug use causes permanent brain damage. This is what they're really referring to. It has permanently affected the brain of the person using it in more than just the initial where you see how it's affecting their mind and their behavior in the moment, but years after the fact. It still affected their wiring, their circuitry, how they process information, how they respond to stress.
Mm-hmm.
It's physically changed that connection in their brain.
Sure. Yeah. No, good answer. Here's another one of those almost unanswerable questions. But is a person born an addict?
Well, there is, and that continues to be, I think, a big debate. I think I can only speak for where I've landed on that topic is that genetics can play a role. Genetics can make some people more susceptible to respond to repeated substance use over time, to where it turns into what we call addiction, whereas mm-hmm. other people can maybe go through periods of hard partying, and genetically they're wired in such a way that maybe they can just kind of put that down and move on with their lives and not get stuck in that ugly cycle.
Right.
I think in my own experience, I can definitely point to a history of addiction in both sides of my family. I've had relatives die from alcoholism. I've had, family members on both sides of that have struggled with various substance addiction. Mm-hmm. Just from what I have learned about over the years of my own family history. Yeah. So it's definitely a component there.
Sure.
I don't think that's all of it, though.
No. As you know, I'm a person in long-term recovery, as you are. And I'll bet I've spoken with 3,000 or more alcoholics, you know, and or drug addicts. Probably more than that. But so often you hear them say, I never understood how people could stop at one or two drinks. That it was always part of their of who they were, part of their physical makeup, that they drank to excess. That one, two, three was never enough. And so that's what leads me to believe, to a certain extent, that you're predisposed.
Oh, sure.
I think to binge or to be an addict. And then of course we also hear addicts say they binge on everything. it's not just one potato chip.
Well, I think that it says a lot about that. It's more than just the mind altering substance itself. That's really just maybe one pleasure seeking outlet that mm-hmm. they're chasing.
Well,
I think it definitely speaks to, I mean, those of us who are predisposed, there's something obviously we're trying to fill. They talk about filling a hole in our life. Mm-hmm. And you can point to early childhood experiences. You can point to maybe just identity as we, you know, progress in age and we go through those stages of identity and mm-hmm. learning about ourselves and adapting. And there's maybe something along that route that went off track.
Yeah. Self-esteem sometimes, mm-hmm. Self-concept. I was highly anxious as a child, as a teenager, and I'm not trying to blame anything, but that mm-hmm. might have had something to do with my need to use substances.
Sure.
So we're talking about a lot of heavy stuff already here. And my guest today on Recovery Chronicles is Josh Frazee, and he is a licensed addiction counselor for Heartview Foundation, and almost 7 years in recovery. So congratulations.
I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch. Yeah, I still have 9 days almost, to go.
Okay, nine
a lot can happen in 9 days.
Well, I think by the time this program airs, it'll be... Tell me where you're from. Tell us a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I grew up in Fargo, West Fargo, that area. Lived there for most of my... pretty much right up till adulthood. When I look back on what I've kind of identified as what got me steered towards substance use, some of the early things I look at were my mom had a lot of emotional problems. She was definitely verbally and emotionally abusive, if not physically. My dad's thing was he was a very good provider. He was a great role model, male role model, probably the best you could have. Except from where I stood, he would come home at night, very successful in the business field, come home, drink himself into oblivion, and that was what we saw of Dad. So what that taught me really early on was that all this success, climbing the ladder, you know, the American dream, the white picket fence, mm-hmm. obviously doesn't make a person happy if they come home to what it's supposed to be all about and just try to tune it out. That was, I think, one of the early things I learned. Mm-hmm. In trying to figure out my way in the world. Another thing that I experienced pretty early on in life was bullying. I was a very awkward looking kid. I know, worse than I am now, right?
They say I think you're a handsome guy, you know?
Well, so, they say I have a great face for radio, but...
I wouldn't say that. Yeah. You had a great face for TV, so... Yeah.
But I was... That was something... I learned pretty early on that I didn't fit in. I wasn't into sports, which is a big part of the culture in West Fargo, certainly at the time I was going to school there. And so I got bullied a lot. I got picked on a lot. The teachers would see this and not do anything about it. A few years after this started up, when I learned to fight back, all of a sudden the teachers are coming in and they're kind of, you know, pinning equal blame or just looking for, I think... maybe, I guess it's hard to explain, but I didn't feel like they were addressing it when it was more one-sided. But when I fought back, all of a sudden they're all over it. So I guess that what that taught me was that there wasn't a place for me in society, that the authorities didn't care about me. They didn't really have my best interests at heart. So what I found that leading to, I think, was my original addiction, which was really crime and rebellion. I got really involved in a lot of just petty crime, shoplifting. I loved shoplifting when I was, you know, from I'd say age 7 into my early teens. That was a really heavy shoplifter.
The rebellious part of it?
Yes. Yeah. It was a big part of just maybe pulling one over on society because I didn't feel like I was welcome in it. So I felt like that was kind of my role. I didn't do a whole lot of drugs in high school. I started experimenting with marijuana early on. It wasn't really until after I turned 18, I moved out of my parents' house and I had my first real taste of freedom that really set in for me.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking just the other day, and as you know, I'm from a different generation. I'm 67, but, I was reflecting the other day that in my day, and I'm not trying to blame society or anything for my addiction, but, and I'm from the big city and, you know, I'm an Irish Catholic, blah, blah, blah. But, drinking was kind of macho. It was considered, unfortunately, I mean, it was looked upon as, you know, that's what tough guys do. Mm-hmm. I mean, my sister wouldn't appreciate me talking about her perhaps, but she was 2.5 years older. She kind of liked, guys who rode these choppers, in other words, chopped Harleys. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They were beer drinkers. And I often hung out with my sister and her friends. And I really think that got me into some early trouble. And then one step further, when you broke up with somebody, you know, you were almost required to drink about it, to go out and tie one up. You know, these are just some of the stereotypes. Sure. Hollywood movies, songs. I mean,
the whole genre of music that tells you that's exactly how you deal with your problem.
You know, perpetuating that let's call it perpetuating that romance with alcohol. And then I remember. I apologize for talking about myself, but you're an addiction counselor. You understand. When LSD was the thing, you know, when it was then all these movies came. I remember Peter Fonda starring
Easy Rider,
some movie. Well, I honestly think there was I'm trying to think of the name of the movie, but it glorified the use of hallucinogens.
Sure.
And there I was, you know, at a prime age 16, 17, you know, going to these movies. And so unfortunately, I guess the point is, unfortunately, the media and society seems to build myths around drug use, you know.
And, you know, I think generationally we kind of add to that myth too, because you talked about LSD kind of being something with your generation. Mm-hmm. It actually had a wave when I was around the same age. It was kind of the big thing. And that was part of what attracted me to it was, you know, as a form of rebellion, as a form of acting out, is what us counterculture people were doing. And then that kind of died off. And what I'm hearing more from just talking with some of the younger kids that are experiencing this stuff is it's back again.
Yeah. 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 And that's an interesting. So, you know, you're a relatively young guy. And one of the things that I always tell people who ask me questions about addiction and substance abuse and treatment, I usually tell them, if I brought you over to Heartview, the treatment center, I tell them they would be surprised at how many young people are in treatment, are roaming our hallways. And that used to surprise me when I mean, really that's the trend, isn't it? The addicts are trending younger and younger.
I think the opioid crisis and some of the cases that have been coming out in the news here has really shown a light on that. We're seeing a lot of high school kids, young adults, are the ones that are overdosing from these heroin and fentanyl things. And then you talk to people that know these people. A lot of the people I talk to know all these people that have OD'd and stuff, and they're mixed up with the same scene. I guess what it brings to mind to me was when I went to my first AA meeting in 2005, I remember walking in with this expectation that it was going to be, I remember specifically in my mind, I was thinking it's going to be a bunch of old men chain smoking, drinking coffee, talking about it, the good old days. Couldn't have been any further from the truth. I saw doctors sitting next to homeless hippies living in tents.
Was this in Fargo or?
This was in Portland.
Okay. Yeah, where else have you lived?
Well, I lived in all three West Coast states. That's actually when I graduated from college the first time around. I moved out west and kind of bummed my way up and down the coast.
What was your initial degree in?
It was in photography and graphic design.
Okay.
Which was...
Very creative.
I actually had planned to go to school for pre-med at one point, and there's a whole story behind that. But a couple years in, I didn't quite have my grades where I wanted to. So I could either have worked harder or smoked pot and chosen an art profession. And I found that there's a lot more latitude with art majors.
Yeah.
You can still do a lot of drugs, and as long as you showed up with something, you know, they had to give you an A. So
Was the traveling and moving out west a little bit of a rebellion too, getting away from your Midwestern roots?
I couldn't wait to get out of the Midwest because I always kind of carried that chip on my shoulder that I never felt like I belonged here, never felt like I fit in. And what ended up happening was I moved out to the Midwest moved out to the West Coast, realized I was way more out of my element, and it really didn't take long for the drinking at that point to escalate. It was actually only a few months after I moved out there, expecting to, you know, just be this hard partying, yeah, kind of free spirit that I'd always been. But instead, really quickly, my alcohol use escalated, and that's when problems started to kind of pile up.
Yeah. So how bad did it get?
Drinking or?
The using alcohol, other drugs. What was really the, how bad did it get, the height of your...
I guess it depends on what you consider bad. I mean, when I was really involved with meth, if you consider the fact that I was putting my neck on the line for federal trafficking charges, manufacturing, all that kind of stuff...
That's bad.
That could have been pretty bad, but as it happens, didn't end up receiving those consequences when... It was opiates that I was pursuing. If it was the fact that I was stealing out of people's cabinets, breaking into their houses, stealing from businesses to feed my habit, you could say that was pretty bad. But I guess as far as the law is concerned, it was alcohol that really somehow took me out, even though I never really liked it all that much. But what had happened was all of those other drugs, and especially marijuana, had conditioned me to the point that I didn't want to go without something in my system. So I'd go through these periods where I couldn't get a hold of anything else. Well, the liquor store is always open. Next thing I know, I'm living under a bridge. I'm losing jobs left and right. I was just one of those people that was predisposed to take everything to the extreme because I was at the point that I was drinking mouthwash when I needed to. I mean, I was not too good for, any depth of the barrel.
So living under bridges, et cetera. So now you're extremely vulnerable, at the mercy of bad people.
There's no doubt that there were times that I would come to and I'd be in some unfamiliar place, not quite feeling right. So who knows what people were doing to me. That happened a few times. And looking back on it, I'm amazed that I'm still in one piece.
Yeah. How grateful are you? That word gratitude, should be heard at least once a day, right?
No question.
In therapy. And and at support meetings.
Very much so.
You know, that attitude of gratitude. So what was the turning point? I mean, what was there a straw that broke the camel's back there that made you say, I've got to change and I've got to change now?
Well, I it was a slow process for me. It started when back in 05 when I decided, hey, I'm going to go check out this AA stuff. I mean, I knew I didn't like where my life was heading. So I went and checked that out. I was like, yeah, you know, I definitely should be here. Took me a few more years and a couple times through treatment before I actually got involved in AA. Had a pretty good stretch for about 6 months there where I was hitting it pretty heavy. I was chairing meetings. I was you know, doing service work, doing all this kind of stuff. Found out that I was overdoing that too, because believe it or not, you can overdo it on healthy stuff too. Burnt myself out and ended up relapsing. Ultimately, I had gone through 5 times through treatment by the point that I had come to on September 14th, 2010. Basically, I had burned just about every bridge in town.
Was that out west now, or is that
no,
here
No, that was here in Bismarck.
Okay, okay.
I had basically gotten kicked out of halfway homes, you know, for continued use. I couldn't keep it together. Lost jobs. I'd basically cobbled together every credit card with like 30% interest rate that I could get a cash advance on to be able to get into this really dingy apartment. It was the only place that didn't run credit checks. And some friends of mine from the program had actually just kept 12th stepping me because they knew I was, you know, still drinking. So they kept coming around. They kept, you know, reminding me, no, we're not going to just let you disappear into the void, Josh.
Yeah.
And then one day I was hovered over the toilet, you know, just doing the alcoholic's prayer, you know, just, you know, take me now.
Yeah.
Because I was tired of feeling the withdrawals and just tired of feeling sick. And as in between dry heaves, just this weird glow came over me. And I wasn't sure what was going on, but it was something bigger than myself came over me. Shortly after that, one of my friends that had been 12 stepping me came along with some soup and she said a prayer with me. And I just felt this power come over me. And in the program, they talk about that as your spiritual awakening, or it can be spiritual awakening. I think I liken it to that lightning bolt. It was definitely my lightning bolt moment.
It can happen that way, or it can happen more gradually.
I think it had been building up, but I think my higher power is like, I guess we're not getting through to you, so we really got to give you a good whack over the head here. And kind of gave me that moment, and I've really just tried to hold on to that ever since.
So what is your life like now? I mean, and you know, how does what's working for you now? And of course, you know, you're now working in the addiction field, and I imagine that's rewarding. And
I have an actual relatively stable career for the first time in my life. I actually enjoy having structure. I'm married. I own my own home. I have a car. These little things that you really maybe don't appreciate until you go for years and years without them.
And your life now has a little bit of predictability, which is
a little bit. You know, even the unpredictable stuff isn't enough to drive me into a tailspin like it used to. And I think that's the one thing more than anything that I'm grateful for is that I have some semblance of being able to cope with life on life's terms, because I never used to have that before.
Yeah. What's the rewarding part now about working with people who are in recovery?
Well, what I love about what I do is I get to spend time with people who I understand. I understand the thought processes, the defenses, the resistance, the ambivalence, the fear, the shame, the guilt, all that stuff makes sense to me because I've been there. I've felt it all. So it's, I think, pretty natural for me to work with somebody experiencing that stuff and help them, or at least try to help them navigate to, you know, a point where they can start dealing with it.
Yeah. How many times have you thanked God or your higher power for the credibility that being a person in long-term recovery gives you.
Because
it does, doesn't it?
I guess I can't honestly say I thought about it that way. Mm. I just try to be grateful to have another day to give it my all and just have it in me to give it my all. I guess.
Good.
I don't stop and pay much attention to so much how people I get a lot of reward for how people look at me today, or even if I'll tell them about some of my past, they'll be like, really? I never would have guessed.
Right.
But I just thank God for today.
Yeah.
And I try to do that every day.
There are people listening to this radio program right now, and they might think they would like some help, or that maybe they're recognizing that they have a problem, or they've known it and they've been putting off doing something about it. What's your advice?
Well, if they're in the state of North Dakota, you are fortunate in that you're in one of the states where you're not too awful far from a ton of resources. Mm-hmm. This state has a lot of unique advantages for somebody that's looking for help versus some of the other states I've looked into. The Human Service Center, for example, in the state of Washington has a 9-month wait list. Mm. I can't imagine trying to keep it together for that long until you can even get in for an eval.
Yeah.
But we've got service providers both in the public and the private sector. Any one of them, just pick up the phone, make that appointment, you know, talk with somebody, see what they have to say. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that any recommendation they make is because they want you to have the best for you. It's not because, you know, they're operating under some sinister purposes, because believe me, there's not that kind of money to be made in this field.
Right. No, I don't think anybody ever became an addiction counselor for the cash, you know.
And if you're not quite sure about that, there are meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous every day of the week. Mm. I would just encourage you to maybe check out one of those. You don't have to share. Just go there and say, I'm here to listen. You might be amazed at what you hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you don't have to talk. You can say, I'll pass, and everybody respects that. And there are a number of open meetings in Bismarck, Mandan, and elsewhere. And that means that you do not have to be an addict to attend. Family members can attend. Anybody can attend. And
they're, like the name suggests, they're open to the public. So they welcome people to come in and just kind of hear stories.
Right. And they're listed on, you can look meetings up online.
Yeah.
They're in the newspaper.
Yes.
In the
events section.
In the events section. And, you know, I guess I could mention Heartview has lists of meetings. And I think anybody could stop in and ask for such a list.
Absolutely.
Josh, the half hour went quickly, as I knew it would. But, you know, thank you for this tremendous service.
Well, thank
coming
you.
On and,
thank you for having me. It's been a great time. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it went fast. We usually close with the serenity prayer, if you don't mind. So God grant me the serenity to accept
the things I cannot change,
the courage to change the things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you.